This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Mavericks and the Spurs played out a brilliant slate of games. Detroit and Cleveland likewise hit the target that one aims to hit when building up the drama basketball provides, at best. Now, how much will we get from four remaining sides? Joining me now on the line to discuss the NBA fourth season is Benjamin Hockman of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Benjamin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The Phoenix Suns went into Dallas and split the first two games of the series. The Suns have only been to the NBA Finals twice, in 1976 and in 1993. They have never won it all. The Mavs have never been to the Finals. Could there have been a better Western Conference Finals matchup?
Of course. That would have been Dallas against San Antonio.
They had that a little early.
Yeah, you got Christmas the day before. But when you look at what that would have been, it would have been the two Texas teams in the conference finals, the two best teams record-wise in the Western Conference. It would have been a very exciting series, obviously, because the one we saw was very exciting.
Oh, it was a pip, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. But the rules are what they are, and they'll change them, but this is what we're dealing with this year. Nevertheless, what we're dealing with now is a great series between the Suns and the Mavericks with a lot of storylines to boot, and one that I've been excited about is the emergence of Boris Diaw. You look at him a year ago, he couldn't even flourish in Atlanta. And now, he's the most improved player in the NBA. He's a triple-double candidate every night. He's silky. He's fun to watch. And obviously, he hit the game-winning shot in Game 1, which capped off a 34-point night. And of course, this series is about Nowitzki and Nash, two really close friends, floppy-haired bosom buddies, if you will. They're not only the best players on their respective teams, but they both finished in the top three of the league MVP voting. And not only that, but I saw him pop up on Deadspin.com yesterday in an old video of the two of them doing a acoustic guitar duet a la Simon and Garfunkel, and it was probably the funniest thing I'd seen since I saw Wedding Crashers. It was a hoot. So these guys are just goofball guys that happen to be superstar NBA players, and one of them is going to be in the NBA Finals.
Will fans in Dallas revolt should the suddenly defensive-minded and much-improved Mavericks not advance to the finals?
Well, perhaps Mark Cuban will. I could envision him punishing his players by forcing them to watch his short-lived reality show.
He's got the tape somewhere, you figure.
I'm sure he does. He's the only one. I don't think his mom even watched that one. I think when you look at the Mavericks and their fans, whether the Mavericks win or lose, it's really been a splendid season for Dallas, and when you look at that team, you see the rise of two people, one being Dirk Nowitzki and the other being the coach, Avery Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you look at Dirk Nowitzki, in previous years he'd been lumped in that all-star category of, you know, Ray Allen and Tracy McGrady, really good players, but he never really separated himself from that group. But this season has been magical for him. And then when you look at Avery Johnson, here's a guy who we joke about has done the incredible. He's gotten the Mavericks to play defense, which is like getting the Knicks to play team basketball.
Come on, let's not go too far with this.
Yeah, well, that's true. But it really has been special to watch the Mavericks play just tough, gritty defense, which had been their Achilles heel in previous season.
Miami managed to split its first two games against Detroit in Detroit. Are the Pistons wearing down after one of the best regular seasons in NBA history?
Gosh, it seemed that way in the final minutes of the second game. The Pistons allowed, 17 points in the final 2 minutes. I had to laugh watching Ben Wallace, listening to him after the game. He said, our bench, you know, the contributions of our bench really helped us out. And I'm thinking, what contributions from the bench? Their bench scored 3 points in the whole game.
Yeah, but they only won by four. Otherwise, it's a one-point game.
There it is, yeah. I have to wonder if the bench is going to affect Detroit down the stretch. Can this lack of punch coming off the bench hurt them? It's possible. And I think the Pistons have to split in Miami. And I just worry for their sake, do they have enough in the tank for the next game? Because if they lose this game, now they're down 2-1 behind the eight ball in Miami.
At first glance, Miami head coach Pat Riley's strategy of keeping Shaquille O'Neal on the bench at the end of games seemed a little odd, but that strategy has worked during the postseason, hasn't it?
Yeah, he's just trying to do whatever he can to get the most out of Shaq, and if that means resting him and letting other guys in there, you got to do what you got to do, even if it means benching a legend. Shaq is going to be so key in the next few games. Obviously, that's probably the most blatant, obvious statement I've said in weeks, but it's true. Shaquille O'Neal must rise to the occasion. But late in the game, if he doesn't have that energy or that versatility, they might have to work around it.
Well, of course, part of the versatility that he would have to display is the ability to sink a foul shot, say, oh, I don't know, 2 out of 3 times.
Yeah, that would be helpful, I think.
Many NBA pundits are of the opinion that this postseason has offered a disproportionately high number of NBA playoff games that will someday be considered classics. For those of us who sometimes can't make it past midnight, what have we been missing?
It's been a carnival. It's probably been the most exciting NBA playoffs I can remember. There's been so many storylines, your head's going to explode. I think of Kobe Bryant versus the Suns, going head-to-head against Rajah Bell, who suddenly became this defensive superstar. And then, of course, we saw the rise of LeBron James. Obviously, a talented player. We always knew he had the stuff, but was he a leader? Could he put his team on his back? And Jordan-esque, stomped through the first round of the series with triple doubles and game-winning shots. We saw the fall of the Titan, the San Antonio Spurs. Here's the defending champs with some of the best players in the league, not even getting to the conference finals. And we also saw the emergence of the coolest team in the country, but maybe not in its own town, that being the L.A. Clippers.
All right, it's time to make you earn your money. Which teams will advance to the finals, and which dozen or so hoopsters will enjoy the privilege of having their names engraved on the much-yearned-for Holy Grail of the Hardwood, the coveted Larry O'Brien Trophy?
Okay, here it comes. I'm going with Dallas versus Detroit. And I think Dallas is going to do it. I think this is their year.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing team ball. The defense, when it's on, it's on. I just think it would be great for the league because you've got your combination of team play and superstars with Dirk Nowitzki. I'm excited about the next few weeks. I'm definitely going to tune in.
Benjamin Hockman covers the NBA for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He joins us from time to time to discuss basketball. Benjamin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No problem. Thank you.
I have a friend, his name is Simon.
Simon.
He is so nice, and we all love him.
Love him.
We have been friends for about 8 years.
Yeah.
I had a few laughs, about 9,000 beers. Simon's the crown, and I am the coach. But if you ask me, the guy's a bit of a joke.
On Wednesday evening, a couple of hours before they would play the Red Sox at Fenway Park, the members of the New York Yankees strolling into the visitors' dugout showed no signs of panic. That may surprise fans who've been reading about all the ways in which the 2006 Yankees have been rendered incomplete, if not irrelevant. Two of the team's starting outfielders, Gary Sheffield and Hideki Matsui, have missed chunks of the spring, and Matsui will miss the summer as well with a broken wrist. Erstwhile unhittable fireballer Randy Johnson has lost almost as many times as he's won while giving up almost 6 runs a game. No matter, among those casually chewing tobacco or spitting sunflower seeds on the Yankees bench is pitching coach Joe Kerrigan, the embodiment of calm confidence.
These players here with the Yankees are so resilient because they've been through so many wars together, especially the core players, that I think they don't even flinch. They just keep going about their business, the daily grind. And I think everybody realizes that they have to turn it up a notch, and they usually do.
So far, those turning it up the proverbial notch have included many of the usual suspects. Shortstop Derek Jeter has been hitting about .350, and he's already knocked in nearly 40 runs. Alex Rodriguez and Jason Giambi have also been productive at the plate. After a few uncharacteristically ineffective appearances, reliever Mariano Rivera has reached double digits in saves. As a result, the Yankees, who beat Boston Wednesday night without starting catcher Jorge Posada and starting center fielder Johnny Damon, are about where people have come to expect them to be, in contention. And they are there without benefit of the best available and healthy talent owner George Steinbrenner's money could have bought over the past month. This, says Tyler Kepner, who covers the Yankees for the New York Times, bespeaks the wisdom of the Yankees' general manager.
Well, I think Brian Cashman having a little more influence here now, you know, that might be part of it. I mean, I think Brian tries to see the long-term picture as well and, you know, not to panic. And if you're going to make a trade, you know, make a well-thought-out trade where, you know, probably more for pitching than for anything else, we might see the Yankees go a little bit more in that direction of being a little more careful rather than just giving anybody a way to put a Band-Aid on a problem that might go away soon enough.
Patience is a fine thing, but it doesn't hurt the confidence of this ball club to know that the owner can buy pitching, hitting, base stealing, or whatever else the Yankees might need if somebody stumbles or slumps. But according to backup catcher Kelly Stinnett, who joined the Yankees this spring after 12 seasons with six different teams, so far nobody on the bench is worried about imminent personnel changes.
Each year there's a, you know, maybe a time or two during the season where you're going to go through some kind of stretch, whether you're not doing something, you're hurt, you know, this or that. So this is one of those stretches. We're just going to make that, hopefully make that stretch really small and come out of it real quick.
Maybe better to have it happen in May than in September.
Yeah, exactly. That's when you want it to happen. If it's going to happen, is in May. So, you know, by the time September rolls around, we'll be in the groove.
And nobody would be surprised because the Yankees always seem to be there in the fall.
Well, that's where we want to be. That's why you put the pinstripes on every day.
If you're grinding your teeth at that characterization of this team that has been preposterously successful over the years, don't blame Kelly Stinnett. Remember, he's not exactly a career pinstriper. He's been playing or sitting on the bench mostly for unsuccessful teams in Milwaukee, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and Kansas City, among other places, since 1994. At age 36, maybe he deserves the ride this year's Yankees seem likely to provide him. Among the other newcomers who were similarly optimistic is pitcher Scott Erickson, who's been making his living at baseball even longer than Kelly Stinnett has. The winner of 20 games with the Twins 15 years ago and 16 twice with the Orioles during the middle 90s, Erickson is a spot reliever with New York these days. He's new enough to the Yankees that he still refers to New York as they, but he seems delighted and feels confident regarding his new employer's 2006 prospects.
Yeah, how can you not? They've been in the playoffs for about the last 10 or 15 years, it seems like, and there's no reason they shouldn't be in the contention this year, right down to the wire, and hopefully one of the four playoff teams.
Apologies, Yankees haters everywhere, but at this point in the season, injuries and disappointing performances notwithstanding, Mr. Erickson's prediction seems not just hopeful, but reasonable. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, everything you always wanted to know about Zambonis, but felt too silly to ask about. But first, yesterday was Carb Day in Indianapolis, the last chance for drivers and crews to come up with the perfect setup. Word has it that the occasion has overtaken Pole Day as an attraction among racing fans. Will there be any excitement left for Race Day? I spoke with Steve Ballard, who covers Indy racing for the Indianapolis Star, during a break in yesterday's action and asked him if Carb Day is really all it's throttled up to be.
It's a great day for the fans. It makes it a little bit like an amusement park out here for the day. And there's a concert this afternoon and stuff, so it's just kind of a, you know, a fun day for the fans to come out here and, you know, enjoy the place before we get down to racing on Sunday.
Many of our listeners have never been to the Indianapolis 500. Can you describe what it's like to see the race in person?
You know what? I can't, and I'm not sure that anybody can. I suspect it's kind of like an astronaut trying to figure what it's like to walk on the moon or something. You know, it's one of those things you kind of have to be here to experience it. When you've got, you know, 270,000 people in a confined space, and the cars lined up before the race, and just, you know, the excitement and the anticipation, and it's an experience unlike anything that I've ever felt in any other major sporting event that I've been involved with.
Sam Hornish Jr. easily won the pole for Sunday's race. He was so fast in qualifying that his warm-up lap would have landed him in the second row, and he reportedly took a nap while his competitor spent the rest of the day trying to beat him. So does he start pouring the milk now?
Well, it's one thing to go around here 4 laps, 10 miles. It's another thing to go around here 200 laps, 500 miles. So, and Sam would be the first one to tell you he's had some bad luck here. He hasn't gotten to the end of one of these yet, so he certainly is the favorite going in. In fact, we just finished up the final practice here just a few minutes ago, and he was, you know, the fastest guy out there again. But I wouldn't say he's one chance in 33. He's got a bigger chance than that, but it's no sure thing by any means.
Defending champion Dan Weldon is also in a good position for Sunday's race. Can we expect big things from the cheeky Brit?
Definitely. He's been a little bit under the radar this year. I think, you know, he kind of was last year because of all the hoopla around Danica Patrick, and now did this year with the two Penske drivers being so dominant. Dan's kind of been in the background again, but he's starting on the front row tonight, right next to the Penske guys. He obviously knows his way around his place. He's got a fast car, so I would definitely expect him to be a major player here on Sunday.
As you mentioned, this time last year, most of the attention was not going to eventual winner Dan Weldon, but to Danica Patrick. Will that change anytime soon?
It's not quite the zoo it was here last year around her. I think she's not quite the novelty that she was last year, but don't make no mistake about it. I mean, she's still the star of the show. There was a media day here yesterday. A lot of the national media are just getting in this week, and they had a media day. She drew at least twice as many as any other driver in the field, you know, clamoring around her. And of the 33 drivers in this race, I mean, she is by far the, you know, the one the most recognizable to the general public.
Patrick has had a busy year. She got married, converted to Catholicism, wrote a book, won the Rookie of the Year award, and, oops, didn't win any races. So she's been struggling in that regard. Can she recover?
You know, I would disagree with that a little bit, that she's been struggling. And people forget that she's just two races into her second season. I think Dan Weldon was into his 30th-plus race before he won the first time. And based on her experience, I think she's done as well as could have been expected and then some. Now, you know, if we get 2 or 3 years down the road and, you know, she hasn't won a race, then maybe we've got something to talk about. But I hear the comparisons to Anna Kournikova, for example, and things like that. And in my opinion, we're a long, long ways away from anything like that.
One of my favorite stories from this year's race is Michael Andretti, who came out of retirement to race against his 19-year-old son, Marco, who's running his first Indy. The elder Andretti says he'll be more relaxed racing than he would be watching his son from the stands. All his father-son talk is very sweet, but can we count either Andretti out?
No, I don't think any driver with that name in any race, you can't ever count him out. In talking to Michael before we really got going here, his main motivation in being here was the opportunity to race against his son, or to give his son the opportunity, I guess, to race against him, just like Michael had in racing against his father. As this month has gone along, and as Michael has spent more time in the car and the race has gotten closer and everything, I think his main motivation now is just to go out and win the race. You know, he's 0-14 here. He's come close so many times. And if he has to beat Marco to do it,
right,
you know, all the better.
Steve, as happens every year at this time, experts have been opining on the fate of Indy racing. An executive at Honda, the league's only engine manufacturer, recently said, "I think the clock is ticking. It's increasingly difficult to lure sponsors." Others say the popularity of Danica Patrick and a marketing agreement with the rock band Kiss point to a resurgence. What do you think?
I don't think we're quite at either one of those extremes. I'm not sure you could say that there's a resurgence, but I don't think we're, you know, the sport isn't on life support either. Just about everybody in the sport has long come to the conclusion that these two series need to get back together, and there are indications right now with the heads of the two series having some serious discussions. You know, looking forward, I think that's the first thing that has to happen, is to have one strong, viable, clear-cut open-wheel racing series, and then, you know, that's not going to solve all the problems by any means, but it's a good first step to getting manufacturers and fans and sponsors, you know, back involved in a meaningful way in the sport again.
Steve Ballard writes about auto racing for the Indianapolis Star. I spoke to him on Friday. Oh, sorry, I mean Carb Day. Have a cold? Here's a Kleenex. Worried about the potato salad spoiling? Put it in the Frigidaire. And if you need a gleaming new sheet of ice, who you gonna call? Zamboni. Zamboni ice resurfacing machines have smoothed ice at NHL matches, at the Winter Olympic Games, and at thousands of college, high school, and community rinks around the globe. Even Woodstock, Snoopy's tiny feathered friend in the Peanuts comic strip, has used a Zamboni to clean the ice on his frozen bird bath. Only a Game's Ken Shulman set out to investigate this icon of ice cleaners. He found the Zamboni factory, and right where you'd expect it, just 20 miles south of Los Angeles.
This is Iceland. The Olympic-sized skating rink looks a little out of place here in the Los Angeles suburb of Paramount, amidst the roses and cacti and palms. Iceland was built in 1940 by Frank Zamboni. Born to Italian immigrants in Utah, Zamboni came to Paramount with his brother in the 1920s. For years, they ran a successful ice factory. Then a new invention called the refrigerator sent their business into a skid. Zamboni decided to give skating a whirl. It wasn't that he was a huge hockey fan.
He was interested in the mechanics of the skating business, and particularly how to make a better sheet of ice for the operator.
Richard Zamboni is Frank's eldest son and the president of Frank J. Zamboni & Company, Incorporated. That's right, Zamboni. That funny-looking box that turns old ice into new. The magic wand on wheels, erasing thousands of ruts and scrapes in the time it takes Joe Fan to down a beer and a dog. When his father opened Iceland, Richard Zamboni recalls, it took three people with squeegees, buckets, and brooms an hour and a half to make a new sheet of ice.
He wanted to have skating enjoyable to as many people as he could for as long a period as he could, because that's how the rink would pay for itself. As he took that on, he tried some mechanical ways to do the same job that three or four people would do in an hour and a half, and he thought there had to be a better way.
Frank Zamboni didn't find that better way right off. It took nearly 10 years of tinkering. His first attempts failed, and miserably. Zamboni had no formal engineering training, had left school after the ninth grade to help his father support the family. Yet the former ice maker refused to give up.
He was always thinking outside the box. How can we do it? How can we get it done, even though it hadn't been done before? He said on the first machine that if people hadn't said he couldn't do it, he probably wouldn't have finished the machine. But they said that, and that gave him some backbone to keep going.
In 1949, Zamboni's Model A ice resurfacer took its first spin around the rink at Iceland. The primitive prototype was a far cry from this model that resurfaces the rink today, fully electronic, relatively sleek, with high-speed brushes and high-tech hydraulics. With a wooden plank storage tank perched on a surplus wartime Jeep frame, Zamboni's Model A tottered around the ice like a runaway barn on wheels. But the machine did the job, even though its inventor hadn't quite figured out how to discard the nearly 3,000 pounds of ice shavings. Today, the Model A lies in state at the far end of the Iceland rink. It's a monument to Frank Zamboni's tenacity and his talent for scavenging.
Well, my dad was out scraping around anything he could get for parts and whatnot. The transmission transfer case out of Jeep. The axles are out of two front ends, out of a Dodge trucks, Army trucks. The cylinder there, done some research on that, and that's really out of the landing gear for a Douglas aircraft.
1 year after its debut at the home rink, Frank Zamboni's strange hybrid vehicle caught the attention of skating and film star Sonja Henny, who was training with the cast of her traveling ice show at Iceland. Henny ordered two of the machines for her troupe. Zamboni drove the second one himself, all the way from Paramount to Detroit. In 1954, still looking at the industry as a sideline to the rink business, Frank Zamboni built 10 more machines for clients including the Boston Garden and the Providence Arena. Six Zamboni machines at the 1960 Winter Olympics at Squaw Valley paved the way for the company's first international sales. The Zamboni factory is housed in an eggshell-colored warehouse just a few blocks from Iceland. About 30 people work here, welding frames, mounting storage tanks, and testing the machines. The Zamboni company no longer builds the resurfacers from scratch. Many components are produced off-site. The U.S. Army surplus Jeep motors that powered the first few generations have been replaced by Nissan automobile engines. The clattering conveyor belt that once hoisted snow into the storage tank has given way to a silent vertical screw. The new resurfacers sell for up to $90,000 each, more than 10 times the price of the first Model A. But the basic workings of the machine are unchanged. It scrapes away a thin sliver of ice, it washes ruts and gouges, and it leaves a strip of fresh ice behind. From the stands, it looks like a mechanized snail, painting a magic trail behind it. It's not rocket science or rocket speed. The machine tops out at 9 miles per hour. But it is awful cute, says company general manager Paula Cooney.
It looks like a large box shaped machine on wheels, and it just kind of goes around, crawls around slowly, and you see the kids run up to the glass at the dashboards, and they want to take a look at it and get close to it. We've had a lot of people say that to them, the name and the look of the machine, it's just kind of like the mascot of the arena. And some of the arenas even dress it up. The San Jose Sharks have a shark fin on the top of it. Some folks we've seen pictures they'll send in where they paint it to look like a race car.
The Zamboni company does have competitors in both North America and Europe. Yet none of the rival brands is as readily identifiable as Zamboni's. And none can boast of being the official ice resurfacing machine of the NHL. Cooney says the secret lies in the quality of the product and, she admits, in the name.
It's something that's easy to remember, and it makes you stop and scratch your head when you think about it connected with something on the ice. You'd think it would be like, you know, the cool machine or the ice box. My mom thought that I was going to work for a pasta company.
When Frank Zamboni was hammering away at what would eventually become his Model A, he had no idea he was building an industry that would employ three generations of his family, produce over 8,000 machines, and teach legions of rink rats the true meaning of the word eponymous. Nor could he have known that he was crafting a brand that would somehow be etched into the skating public's imagination. It's a niche market, and an idiosyncratic one. Still, on rinks all over the world, when it's time to spread a new sheet of ice, they'll be waiting for Zamboni. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Paramount, California.
You're listening to Only a Game. In an email this week, Gretchen Sommerfeld, a WBUR listener, expressed her thanks for Karen Given's story in last week's program updating the progress of kayaker and biker Renata Klumska as she continues to circumnavigate the contiguous United States. Ms. Sommerfeld wrote, "The week before I heard the story, I had actually driven by Ms. Klumska on Route 3A in Hingham, headed toward the harbor, and I thought to myself, I know I heard something about this woman. What was it?" So I was thrilled to be reminded a week later. At least one listener, Sean K. Dunlap, who hears Only a Game on KSUT in Durango, Colorado, apparently feels that we've been paying too much attention to the wrong home run hitter. "I love the show. Never miss it," he wrote. "I am wondering when people will start talking about the achievements of Albert Pujols rather than the saga of Barry Bonds. Shouldn't Major League Baseball invest in its future and not destroy its past?" My conversation last week with John Eisenberg, the author of The Great Match Race, provoked some correspondence. Don Roper of New Paltz, New York, sent an actual letter after showing it to everyone here at the station and eliciting numerous oohs and a couple of ahs and one "what's that" from an intern. I read it. The author may have missed a first-hand account of the race from a late May issue of the New York Patriot of 1823, Mr. Roper wrote. This account can be found in Volume 1 of the Letters and Journals of James Fenimore Cooper on page 99. Mr. Cooper may have collected a few bets on Eclipse. Which brings me to an email from John Leyes, who wrote, "Why did you let me down by not telling me who won the race? I felt cheated. This is not the only time that I've heard this kind of story and haven't heard the result of the match, game, etc. I'm getting to the point where I will prefer to listen to a few CDs rather than be disappointed again and again." For the record, Eclipse did in fact win the third and deciding heat against Henry on that spring day in 1823, enabling the North to claim equine superiority over the South and Mr. Cooper to finish the last of the Mohegans in relative peace. You can email us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, or you can reach us through the website onlyagame.org. Like Mr. Roper, you can send us a letter at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the solution to the riddle of the babe's seven cigar butts. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Only seven?
Yes. Yesterday was carb day at the Brickyard. Did you forego that Indy 500 tradition because of your diet?
No. It's not about food. It's about the last practice trip around the lap, and it has allegedly become the second biggest day in the month of May at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which, of course, the biggest day being the race over Memorial Day weekend. And, of course, my traditional objection to the Indianapolis 500 is that it is, in fact, held in Indianapolis.
Well, a legitimate objection, I'm sure. But who's going to win the race?
I don't know. I think I'm going to pick Helio Castroneves because I've never picked anyone named Helio before.
Oh, there you go. I wonder what Danica Patrick, speaking of the Indy 500, would make of NASCAR legend Richard Petty's assertion that women don't belong in auto racing.
You know, Richard Petty was wrong in 1976 when he said Janet Guthrie shouldn't have driven in the Coca-Cola 600. He's wrong now. 10 years from now, when somebody else asks him the question, he's going to be wrong then. But the other thing is that he's still going to be Richard Petty, which is very cool.
The Detroit Pistons beat the Miami Heat in Detroit on Thursday. That evened the Eastern Conference Finals at one game apiece. Were doubts about Detroit's general health and stamina after Game 1 premature?
Slightly premature, although they did almost give the entire lead back at the end of the game. They only won it by 4 points. And I don't know if you managed to get a look at Ben Wallace after the game, but he looked like he'd been fed headfirst into a meat grinder. Guarding Mr. O'Neill is apparently not a job for the squeamish, but it does involve my favorite Hubie Brown stat of the playoffs, in which Hubie Brown informed us that Shaquille O'Neal outweighs Detroit center Ben Wallace by 85 pounds.
Detroit had to beat Cleveland to get the opportunity to play Miami. This week, the Cavaliers extended the contract of head coach Mike Brown, who is the sixth coach to have headed the Cavs in 6 seasons. How will Cleveland players handle this weird phenomenon of stability?
Who's this guy? Why is he back?
Why is he back? I didn't even learn his name. Well, I figured he'd be gone.
Mike Brown established his bona fides in the only way that matters in Cleveland, which is basically getting along with LeBron. He got into the playoffs. They played very well in the playoffs. They had the Detroit Pistons beaten and then let him up, a sign of a young team. Mike Brown did a terrific job. This is for the first time since LeBron James has been with the Cavaliers, and he's probably not going to be with them very long. They look like a stable franchise.
The Edmonton Oilers, who have not been to the Stanley Cup Finals since 1990, are just one game away from their first post-Gretzky final. Would an Edmonton championship help the National Hockey League in its comeback?
I have no idea. I never understood the, you know, I understand how it happened when they folded the WHA teams into the league, but frankly, there was a reason why the original six didn't go any further west than Toronto. Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, a lot of these cities can't support a major sports team. That being said, I'd rather see Edmonton in the finals than the mighty Ducks of Disney, Anaheim, down the block, mighty exit 29B, take a left and then take a right up the street from the Wadi Doodah, mighty Ducks.
Elsewhere in hockey, Ted Nolan, who was replaced as coach of the Buffalo Sabres 9 years ago, hasn't had a job in the National Hockey League since, and he says he knows why that is.
He's an Ojibwe Indian. He says that racism is keeping him out. Nolan's complaint is not a new one in the NHL. Way back, Henry Boucher, the Ojibwe who lived in War Road, Minnesota, and played in the NHL for a while, had much the same complaints. Aboriginal rights people in Canada will tell you it's general throughout society. To be fair, we should point out that Ted Nolan was offered the job with the Tampa Bay Lightning in the 1990s and turned it down. You know, he cited family reasons at the time. But do I think there's more than a germ of truth in what he's saying? Yes.
Among the gifts sent to Barbaro since the Preakness were apples, stuffed animals, and religious statues. Charlie, have you been surprised at the level of interest people have shown in Barbaro since he sustained that life-threatening injury?
Surprised, shocked, appalled, you name it. I'm glad the horse is okay. I'm glad he will go on. I know he probably ate the apples. I hope he didn't eat the religious statue. But we went pole vaulting over the line into anthropomorphic fetishism this week, and I'm just as glad that it's probably over.
Pat Summitt, who has coached the University of Tennessee women's basketball team to somewhere between 900 and 10 million wins, reached another numerical milestone this week, Charlie, and I understand she can take this one to the bank.
Yeah, she got a raise. She's the first millionaire coach in women's basketball, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if this was done spontaneously by the University of Tennessee to keep Gino Auriemma from Connecticut becoming the first million-dollar women's coach, because he's due to become that next year. And this was a raise that Pat Summitt was granted. So I have a feeling this is a big thumb to the nose by the University of Tennessee.
Indiana men's head coach Kelvin Sampson will not be allowed to recruit off campus after the NCAA ruled that he and his staff at Oklahoma violated recruiting rules there. Where's Isaiah Thomas when you need him?
He's wrecking the New York Knicks. Thank you for asking.
He's busy, right.
Where's Steve Alford when you need him is a better question. He's still in Iowa wondering how the heck Indiana could have gotten into his mess. Indiana should cut ties with this guy right now. It's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. The team isn't going to be any good. And frankly, this guy isn't worth the hassle they're going to have.
Albert Pujols is on a pace to hit 80 or more home runs this season. If you were him, wouldn't you maybe be trying to hit home runs just a little less frequently, you know, to keep the heat off?
I would hit as many home runs as I could, and I would tell anybody who asked that question he's a McCarthyite idiot who doesn't belong anywhere near a keyboard, a pencil, a piece of paper, or thoughtful human beings. The single most remarkable stat of Albert Pujols' start to me is he's only struck out 12 times.
It's usually fine if presidents and potentates wish to attend gala sports events like the World Cup, but will the Iranian president be entirely welcome in Germany for the 2006 event?
Apparently not. He is an elected but unreconstructed nutball who said a bunch of dizzyingly awful things about Israel. This is a problem the Germans don't want. The problem, of course, is how do you do it? The guy's the elected leader of the country. His team is there. He's entitled to go.
How do you like German national soccer team coach Jürgen Klinsmann's training strategy, Charlie?
I think players, you know, should have something to fall back on if the soccer doesn't work out. I think learning a trade is a good thing. He's sending them to a watch repairing class, but he doesn't really have a good reason why. I guess he just figures that, you know, it's safer than letting them run amok in Germany.
Remember back in the politically incorrect days when we used to mention athletes with great names, Charlie?
Yes.
And how come the women's pro softball team, the New England Riptide, didn't sign Destiny Frankenstein back then when we could have talked about her?
Why couldn't they have at least signed her at Halloween? One of the great names of all time, and not only a great name, but Destiny Frankenstein comes from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is also a great name.
Charlie Pierce, one of a kind, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me here each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Destiny.
This spring has brought a new biography of one of the second greatest home run hitters of all time. The Big Bam, subtitled The Life and Times of Babe Ruth, was written in part, quote, to bring back the supposed to be uncomplicated in the time of the complicated. So writes Lee Montville, the author of The Big Bam, in the book's introduction. Lee Montville joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with that phrase from the introduction. What did you mean by the supposed to be uncomplicated?
Well, I think when we look backwards, we always look at the lives and the high points and the low points and not the in-between. And we very much look at the in-between while we're living them.
Trying to write about Babe Ruth's childhood must have been a frustrating experience. You refer several times to something you call the fog, which seems to obscure much of his youth. Did Ruth just not talk about his childhood, or did the writers covering his exploits refrain from asking about it?
I think it was a combination of both. I have a feeling that he didn't want to talk about it, and the writers, knowing that, didn't ask about it. And all the stuff I looked at, there wasn't one story about his mother, not one quote, not one thing saying, you know, my mother always made me eat broccoli. Nothing, not a word, and not much more about his father. And he in his scant mentions in his supposed autobiographies with ghostwriters, would say things like, I had an older brother who was killed in a street fight. And his surviving sibling, his sister, said, no, he had no older brother. And he would say, my mother was a mixture of English and Irish. And the sister would say, no, she was German. And there's just a fog around. I think all public people have a fog around their personal lives, but man, his is pretty deep.
One of my favorite responses to a Babe Ruth home run came from right fielder Bill Morissette. And this particular home run came before Ruth had ever swung a bat as a professional in a game that counted, right?
Oh, yeah. It was his first day of spring training with the Baltimore Orioles, and the longest home run that had ever been hit at this field in Fayetteville, North Carolina, had been hit by Jim Thorpe, and a white stake had been planted out in the outfield to memorialize the great feat. And here's this 19-year-old kid that smacks it maybe 50 feet beyond the white stake, and it goes across a racetrack. There's a racetrack around that goes across the racetrack. And this Bill Morissette, who was also from Baltimore, he allegedly said, I'm not going to get that ball unless you give me cab money. And, you know, it sounds like something that might have been put into his mouth, but maybe not.
It's one of those things that if he didn't say it, he should have.
Well, yeah. Right? Yeah, I think the sports writers would say to these guys, you wouldn't have got that unless you got cab money. And the guy says, right, so that means he said
that
it.
That means he said it. You discovered that Ruth set lots of records that had nothing to do with home runs or even baseball. Where else did he excel, Lee?
Oh, he would try anything. He was kind of goofy. He up in upstate New York, in the middle of the winter, he pulled out his golf clubs and he hit a golf ball that went onto the ice and supposedly went for a mile, you know, and kept rolling and skidding and going. And he was bowling one time, and it was an old alley, and the balls were all warped, and the Babe went to practice, and he kind of slipped in his delivery, and the ball bounced off the alley and rolled along the floor and hit some stairs and went down the stairs, and the door was open, and there was a hill, and it kept going down. And he always claimed that he had the world's record for the longest bowling ball. And, he went hunting and came back to New York City, you know, driving a car with a bear and two deers strapped across the fenders and stuff, right down through Manhattan.
Henry Aaron hit more home runs over the course of his career than Babe Ruth did, but has any other ball player dominated the game the way that Ruth did during the 20s and early 30s?
No, I mean, he brought a whole new dimension to the game. He virtually invented the home run. I'm sure someone else would have come along and invented it, but when he came along, a home run was pretty much seen as a mistake. A fly ball was a mistake. You were supposed to hit line drives and balls up the middle, and baseball was supposed to be played station to station. The American League record for home runs before he arrived was 16, set by Sox Siebold, the immortal Sox Siebold. Yeah. He was the first guy to hit in the American League to hit 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60 home runs, and the same with 300, 400, 500, 600, and 700 home runs. So he led the way. He was just doing a whole entirely different thing.
Ben Johnson, who was the president of the American League during part of Babe Ruth's career, once said of Ruth, he has the mind of a 15-year-old, and you write that this is, quote, probably the best appraisal of the man in all of the words spoken or written. What particulars led you to that conclusion?
Well, here's the thing with the Babe is that he grew up from age 7 to 19 when he signed a pro baseball contract at St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys in Baltimore, Maryland, which was a orphanage/reform school with 800 to 1,000 boys, all being run by the Zavarian brothers. And every night he would go to bed in sort of a big warehouse kind of a room where there'd be 200 other kids sleeping on bunk beds. And he had no privacy and scant freedom, you know, and they had walls around the place. And the average kid stayed at this school for 2 years, and the Babe was there for 13 years, pretty much. So his childhood was pretty much lost. And so now he gets out, signs a contract with the Baltimore Orioles for pretty good money at the time, immediately is a sensation, is playing with the Red Sox before the end of the year is up, the season is up, and he's gotten a couple of raises. So he not only has freedom, he has money. the world was just a big buffet table out there, and he just jumped on top of it and grabbed as much stuff as he could and never really stopped grabbing.
Ruth's teammates, the men most often in his company, were amazed by his various appetites. What's your favorite anecdote establishing Ruth's larger-than-life status off the field?
Oh, I think it's the one, and it's told by different people in different ways, that he and his roommate have a suite, and they each have separate rooms, and there's a common room in the middle, and the babe has brought a professional woman back to sleep with him that night. And he comes out of his bedroom, and the teammate says, "Isn't the woman still in the room?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "But whenever I'm through with one of my adventures, I like to come out here and smoke a cigar." And they both went back to their bedrooms. And in the morning, the roommate goes in, and he looks at the ashtray, and the number varies, but the one that seems to be right is that there were 7 cigar butts there, which makes 60 home runs sound minimal to my butt.
Anyone familiar with Babe Ruth's life knows that he was terribly disappointed that he never got the opportunity to manage in the major leagues. Specifically, he very much wanted to manage the Yankees, but your treatment of Ruth's retirement, I think, is especially poignant. Would you read from the beginning of chapter 24 in the Big Bam?
Surely. He quickly became a man who played golf and drank in the afternoon. The life and times of Babe Ruth had ended. He wasn't dead, no, but he was an inhabitant of that strange twilight that exists for men who have accomplished all they can early in life and will accomplish no more. The energy still ran through him, the need to move, do, be active, but there really was nowhere to go. "I played 365 rounds of golf last year," he would say. "Thank God for whoever invented golf. I'd be dead without it." He golfed, he bowled, he drank. He attended to the little bits of personal business of each day. He traveled, he went hunting, he went to Florida in the winter. A personal appearance here, a radio show there. He golfed, he bowled, he drank. He tried to kill the energy. The athlete, no matter who he is, once removed from his uniform, looks much older. The babe also looked lost.
Lee Montville is the author of The Big Bam, subtitled The Life and Times of Babe Ruth, published by Doubleday. Lee, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
When I come to see the bay, they say Babe Ruth is dying. Come to lift his spirits just like he was lifting mine. I can't promise any homers. I'm no sultan of swine. But I'll be up there swinging with everything I got.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood and from Vince Fairchild. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Ken Schulman's Zamboni Photo Gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Babe Ruth biographer Lee Montville, who reveals the reason that the babe wouldn't eat asparagus.
Because it makes your urine stink, of course.
Ah, research. I knew if I looked long enough, I'd find something that I have in common with Babe Ruth. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Come to see the babe. They say Babe Ruth is dying. Come to lift his spirits just like he once lifted mine. I can't promise any home.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. WKKF.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. PewTrusts.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows September 20th. This is NPR, National.